Accession number 6024, reel 8.
Mr. Humphrey, reel 8.
A day or two before the physical arrival of Australian troops, the Allied planes had been dropping food into our camp in big canisters. And one of the worst tragedies happened that when one of those canisters went through the roof of a hut and killed a man. Terrible tragedy. He'd survived all that time and then killed in that way. Then on the 11th September, the first we saw was two or three Australians in their digger hats just casually walking up to the entrance to the camp. And I think the informality of these arrangements all resulted from the fact that the camp administration under the Japanese was separate from the Japanese military command in the town. And I have no doubt that negotiations had to go on between the military command in the town, which was much more important from the Allied point of view, to make sure that those people weren't going to shoot them and that they did accept the surrender and withdrew. Well, I subsequently heard that, in fact, the Allies had demanded the withdrawal from Kuching of all their military personnel out of the town so that the Allies could come in and occupy it. And but that did not apply to the Japanese in charge of the detention prisoner of war camp. So I think all this caused a certain amount of confusion, but these two or three Australians just ambled up quite casually, and it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, the thing went around the camp like wildfire, of course. Good heavens, three or four Australians had appeared, you see. But then, naturally, within two or three hours, I mean, there were dozens of them turned up following behind, and then an officer or two started coming, and then we were all assembled and given a talk. Forgotten the rank of that, by an Australian officer, and there was an American officer with him because they'd been carried by the American Navy, and they said they would be making the earliest possible arrangements to get all of us out, that stores of drugs, food and all this were immediately available and would be put through the existing camp channels as the quickest way of getting things that we needed, that lists and all of the people in the camp were being prepared, and people were asked, if I remember rightly, to fill in some form saying where they wanted to go to, if they had any choice, because some people wanted to go east, some west, some south, some north, and others had virtually no choice, depending on their physical condition. This, at the same time, they announced that there would be this service the next day, and they hoped to start people moving, well, literally within 48 hours, and they kept their word. Because I was, together with about 25 or 30 other people, was taken within 48 hours onto an American patrol vessel back to Labuan, where I was promptly put in the military hospital there.
So the gap between the arrival of the Australians and your actual liberation from Kuching was as short as 24 hours?
48 hours.
Mm.
48 hours.
Yes.
My recollection is we were liberated on the 11th of, or it may have been the 10th of September. At any rate, then the next day there was this, amongst other things, this service, and a certain amount of paperwork being done, inquiries being made. And the day after that, we were taken down to the mouth of the Kuching River, to Pending, and went on quite a small American naval vessel where we were admirably looked after. They put us into their accommodation. They slept on deck, they had non-stop coffee and all this sort of thing. They couldn't have been more hospitable.
In that 48 hours, last 48 hours at Kuching, did any of the internees take the opportunity to pay off any old score?
Amongst each other?
No, against the Japanese.
Oh, I couldn't say. I don't know whether they did it directly, but certainly the Australians were asking if any scores needed to be paid off, and I know the Australians lammed in very badly, well, very hard indeed, into some of those Japanese guards. They had their own reasons, I think, for that, because the Australian forces had been so terribly maltreated, the Australian soldiers elsewhere in Borneo, with appalling loss of lives.
What sort of reaction did the Australians have to the conditions they found you all in?
Oh, they were absolutely shocked. Looking back on it, of course, to us, we'd got used to seeing people a fraction of what their real weight should have been. You know, people who would normally have been 12 stone weighing 8 stone. We got sort of used to seeing people look like this and walking around in rags and loincloths and all this sort of thing. But we must have presented an appalling appearance to them. And there's no doubt they thought so too. They immediately came in with clothes, with everything that anyone could have wanted. It was a well-prepared liberation exercise, when we put it that way. And then they had this organisation called RAPWE, Repatriation of Allied Prisoners of War and Internees, which was a movement operating throughout the East to get prisoners of war and internees homeward on where they wanted to go.
After those years of privation, were any of the things that suddenly became available a danger in themselves?
Oh, very much so. Yes, we were warned by doctors right, left and centre not to start eating rich. Some people did, made themselves ill almost at once. There were a lot of people suffering from this condition called edema, with all this water and fluid in their bodies. Well, those sorts of people had to go very carefully with what they ate. If they weren't to aggravate the condition, they had to get rid of it more slowly. But the rations had very much improved 2 to 3 weeks before we were liberated. The Japanese had seen the light, I think, realised there was going to be hell to pay if things didn't look a little bit better, and they'd gone to some pains to do a bit of window dressing for 2 or 3 weeks before we were liberated.
Were you able to detect any significant psychological or emotional impact of this experience? I mean, I'm thinking of it in terms of, there you had been a closed and deprived community for 4 years, or however long it was, and then suddenly you were exposed to people from the outside world who must have seemed really quite strange and quite foreign to you in some ways, even though they were your own kind.
Yes. The great thing everybody was after was news. You see, we still really didn't know what had happened, what had brought an end to the war. Sugar, in some conversation or another, had indicated that some ghastly new weapon had been used by the Americans, but we didn't even know, or hadn't even heard of, an atomic bomb. So I think a large part of the communication we had with the relieving Americans and Australians was really that we were aching to hear, oh, what's the state of the war, what's happened, who's won, and all this. We weren't even terribly sure, you see, of VE Day, of the collapse of Germany. I mean, this had been strong rumour. We didn't really know when it had happened or in what circumstances.
What I was really getting at was, I wondered whether the sudden exposure to freedom presented its own difficulties, not of a physical or kind, but more of an emotional, psychological kind. Was freedom difficult to handle in any ways?
Well, one wasn't immediately free in the sense that one's free now, for example, to do what you liked. I mean, we were absolutely in the hands of the relieving forces. My own experience was not terribly different from that of many others, I think. I mean, I went back to Lebourn, where I was shoved in a hospital, and it certainly wasn't it was a very emotional thing to have so many people from there coming up to see me in the hospital. I mean, there must have been 200 or 300 sort of queues, and I was feeling very ill and didn't really want to be, what, so to speak, on my best socially, but it was very moving indeed, yes. But when I got more, I think, really, than in Kuching, where I knew nobody, you see. Apart from my fellow internees, I didn't know anybody in Sarawak. But when I got back to Lebourn and it got around the island that I was there and stuck in the hospital, it was very moving indeed.
How quickly were you repatriated?
I was in Lebourn about, I could find the actual date, but it was something like a week or 10 days in the military hospital there, maybe in a bit longer. Then a hospital ship came along, called the Marudu, I think, and I, with a number of other people were shoved on this ship and taken to Singapore. I had a bet on with a friend of mine that I'd get home to England before he did, because he started off in the opposite direction. So he pretended that he wanted to go to Australia. He thought if he got to Australia, he'd get home quicker because things would be less crowded. But in fact, we both ended up on the same boat eventually, but at Colombo. I got to Singapore on this ship, where again I was shoved into a hospital in Singapore. But after a few days I got out, and I had many friends in Singapore, of course, including people who'd come back with the British Military Administration, many of whom were former members of the Malayan Civil Service. So then I started wangling a more rapid journey home, and I thought I'd get through the RAP reorganisation, and I more or less thumbed a lift on a plane to Colombo. It's the only journey I've ever made without a passport or anything else. And but at Colombo, I was couldn't get any further, and I was shoved into a naval, really a sort of Wrens camping, I think it was, and was there about another week or so, I suppose, and then got together with a whole lot of other people who'd been picked up all over the East on a vessel called the Highland Monarch, which took us back to England by sea.
And by the time you got home, a fair period had elapsed, so you'd got rather used to the feeling of being free, of being liberated. Did that make your actual homecoming to your parents a relatively straightforward affair, or was that memorable for any reasons?
Oh, they were. They came down to meet the ship at Southampton. We had been kitted out on the way, of course. We'd had a certain amount of tropical clothing and the sort of things you wore in the tropics given us by the relieving forces. But then at Suez, when we were moving into an English winter, they had a large organisation there for issuing clothes to what were called RAPWE personnel, I think. And, you know, you were fitted out with a sports coat, a pair of flannel trousers and all sorts of things which nobody ever wanted to wear, of course, in tropical climates. So I arrived in not somebody else's clothes. They were all new clothes, but in issued civilian clothes. And my parents came down to Southampton to meet me. My father was himself actually very ill and a dying man, which, of course, I didn't know. But they were, well, it was an emotional scene, of course, and they came down by car and I drove home because we lived in those days, not very, well, only about 50 miles from Southampton.
How did they react to you?
It's hard to say. I mean, they were, I think, well, my mother was in tears. I suppose I was.
Do you think that whole experience of internment had any long-term effect on you that you're able to detect?
No, there was a while when I had I was rather concerned that I mightn't be fit for further tropical service.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to the London Hospital for Tropical Diseases and had a long course of anti-malarial treatment, atabrine had then become the fashionable drug for it, and various other tests and things to get all the dysentery and amoebic dysentery bugs out of me, and in fact I've had no trouble health-wise since.
So physically you came out of it okay?
I should perhaps have mentioned, in fact it is important, yes, while at Le Bourne, when I came back, I found that the Japanese had killed several of the people who'd worked under me, you know, Asians who'd worked under me in Le Bourne, the virus dressing, and of course two or three of their widows came along and saw me, and well, in one case at any rate, asked me what the position was about her widow's pension and all that sort of thing. Well, of course I couldn't say a thing. I had no knowledge of what arrangements were being made, and I felt one was rather letting them down. I was also able to get hold of funds there, because fortunately I had a bank account in Singapore and they were still operating, and I was able to reimburse quite a lot of people who had helped me out in the few days that I'd been stuck in the Burn and Brunei jail three or four years previously, emanations.
If the experience had had no effect on you physically, had it had any effect upon you in any other way, in terms of your attitudes, for example?
I think not. I mean, for a while afterwards, there was a great deal of bitterness, I think, throughout the East on the losses people had incurred. The looting that had occurred, not in our part of the world, because Le Bourne was blown to pieces by Allied military operations, but in other parts of Malaya when I got back, a lot of people were bitter that their houses and property had been looted, not by the Japanese, but by the relieving forces, which I know in some cases was true. Some people took a very bad knock indeed. There was a lot of bitterness about people who had got away from Singapore, but all this didn't concern me because I was captured long before the fall of Singapore. So I wasn't concerned with all the argumentation and bitter feelings that many people held about people who they considered had left the country at a time when they shouldn't, or you know, against orders and that sort of thing, just try to save their own skins instead of doing their jobs. But I mean, I wasn't involved in any of that because I was in Japanese hands 6 weeks before the fall of Singapore.
This is perhaps a rather odd sort of question in some ways, but do you think you personally benefited in any way from this experience?
Well, only to the extent I think one can say that all suffering together with other of your fellow men tends to make you a little more philosophical, I think. Yes, I think you get more mature. You're an older man after you've had an experience like that. I mean that not physically, but mentally, I think. Yes, but it's hard to describe it.
Another odd question, perhaps, but after it was all over, was there anything about it that you missed?
Missed? In what way? You mean something that I should have had but didn't have?
Was there anything of the experience that you missed when it was no longer available?
No, perhaps a certain amount of camaraderie in with people and, well, I suppose to some extent, yes, a social and camaraderie mix which circumstances forced on you, some of which was quite congenial. I mean, I made one or two friends then whom probably people I wouldn't have known or wouldn't certainly have known well if it hadn't been for the circumstances in which we had to live together. Mm. One or two of those I'm still in touch with.